for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Tunisia's interim president, Fouad Mebazaa, has promised a complete break with the past. His pledge reflects an attempt to appease protesters who continue to demand that all members of the former government be stripped of power. Joining me to talk about the uprising in Tunisia and why it's being so closely watched by Arab leaders elsewhere, Nadia Bilbasi of NBC TV, that's Middle East Broadcast Center, Nuruddin Jebnoun, he's adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University, joining us from a studio at NPR in New York, Richard Murphy, who served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia. Of course, we welcome your comments, your questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, Nadia.
Good morning, Dan.
And good morning to you, Nuruddin.
Good morning, Dan.
Ambassador Murphy, it's always good to have you with us.
Great pleasure to be with you.
Nuruddin, give us some of the background. What led up to this uprising?
So last December 17th, disturbance erupted in Tunisia after Mohamed Bouazizi, a young unemployed graduate who was condemned to sell like fruit and vegetables on the street, immolated himself in protest after authorities had beaten him and prevented him to work. Then his act crystallized and incarnated like the Tunisians' feeling of humiliation and lack of justice to which they had been subjected for more than 23 years.
And Why was he singled out?
He singled out because he was a symbol. You have thousands of Ali Bouazizi in Tunisia, graduated from universities but unemployed. And the system is very corrupt, based on nepotism, based on favoritism, clientelism. All those elements pushed the young people to revolt, to rebel against Ben Ali's regime.
And how did they initially erupt?
As I said, started by Sidi Bouzid, which is a city in the south of Tunis, capital, which is, I think, 140 miles from Tunis, and then spread it through the whole country from the south to the north and from the east to the west.
Nuruddin Jebnoun, he's at Georgetown University. Nadia Bilbasi, can you give us an update on the situation in Tunisia as of this morning?
Sure, Diane. We have so far five ministers from the ruling or salvation government, temporary government, resigned, and the opposition and the mass demonstration in the streets demanding that nobody from the previous government should serve now. And therefore, they're the one who calling the shot in the streets and saying basically that we have nothing to do. We toppled a dictator, but we have not toppled the dictatorship. We want to make sure that nobody's going to serve. We want to make sure that the opposition leaders are allowed to come back from exile, whether it's in London or in Paris. We have people inside mobilizing a mass demonstrations on every Tunisian city. And therefore, for the time being, this government's supposed to serve temporarily. And in 60 days, they're supposed to have election.
What role did the police and the military play in the ouster of the government of Ben Ali?
This is a very interesting point, Diane. First of all, this is a new phenomenon we have not seen in the Middle East. Number one, the army stayed neutral, and we have not seen the army playing that role before. In fact, the army was seen as supporting the people, and this is we have seen probably in other revolutions, the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine and in Eastern Europe. Even some people were seen posing for photographs with the army. They went to the army for protection from the police. The police are the bad guys who represented the regime. They're the one who opened fire when people initially demonstrated in the street, leading to the killing of about 100 people. But the army seems neutral. There is also talk that actually the army initiated this fear with telling Bin Laden that his regime is about to crumble, and they led to him leaving the country. We don't know if this is true or not, but at least we know for the first time ever that the army stood on the side of the people, and that might not be the case in the rest of the Arab world.
Nadia Bill Basiev, NBC TV. And turning to you, Ambassador Murphy, you say that while the U.S. might applaud this move toward democracy, we're in something of an uncomfortable situation. Describe what you mean.
Well, we don't want to see chaos, which is a near possibility at this moment in time with the continued movement in the streets of the capital and the other centers in Tunisia. We need to work with the liberals, with the moderates, and in the middle term, up to the time of the elections that have been called, to help set the stage that there is really a fair competition, and that either the Islamists or the current ruling parties don't outmaneuver the moderates whom we would like to see succeed in the future of Tunisia.
What has our relationship been with the former ruler of Tunisia?
It's certainly been close. I don't think our eyes have been closed. WikiLeaks reminds the public that our embassy in Tunis has been reporting on corruption, and I think the ambassador titled one of his messages, What's Yours is Mine, describing the ruling family. But in many other areas, it has been a close relationship, and I think dominated particularly by the very firm support of the regime, former regime, against international terrorism, and particularly Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb.
Richard Murphy, he served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia. He's former assistant secretary of state for Near East and South Asian affairs under President Reagan. Do feel free to join us. 800-433-8850. Nuruddin, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I am not concerned about the so-called chaos. Take the case of Spain. Spain began its transition to democracy, but without any prior democratic experience. This is, after Franco, this is what's happening now in Tunisia. People try, like, to build the civil society, try, like, to say to the government, we are moving forward toward a genuine democratization. The chaos, the risk of chaos, is from the militia and from the Praetorian presidential guard left by the fallen president, Ben Ali, and who are now trying to cross the country going to Libya and to be like equipped by weapons from Gaddafi and to come back and to try to spread fear and uncertainty within the Tunisian society, just to say either Ben Ali or the vacuum, either like the dictatorship or the chaos. This is the real concern about the chaos. It's not the Tunisian people are really civilized. You know, the country is the first country that abolished slavery in 1848, the first Arab country had like a constitution in 1861, and the first Arab country abolished polygamy in 1956, and this is the first country which fired its dictatorship in 2011.
Let me also add that Tunisia has one of the most educated population in the Arab world. Very high master degrees, PhDs. It's a secular society, very enlightened. If you saw the demonstration, Diane, as I saw them on Arabic television, of mass movement of people, you see women uncovered. no veils. It's very rare to see this in the Arab world. You see Che Guevara's posters replacing that of Hassan Nasrallah. This is something completely new. We haven't seen that before. So I think I agree that Tunisia is not out of the danger zone yet. But I think considering the history of the country, considering the potent both opposition from the secular and Islamist party, that eventually they will lead it to success.
What about the economic and political conditions that led up to this uprising?
Well, I mean, basically, if you look just at the regime and examine the wealth that he amassed at the expense of the people. I mean, now we're talking about the Swiss government freezing the assets of Ben Ali. We're talking about his wife, which is a very interesting character, and we should look at her, Leila Tarabulsi and her family. This woman came from a very humble background. She managed to climb her way up to the highest position, and they were talking about $5 billion being stolen from the coffers of the Tunisian people, basically to help a lifestyle of luxury for the ruling family, basically.
And do we know the actual rate of unemployment in Tunisia?
I think the rate of unemployment among the youth is about 30%, you know, which is very high in Tunisia. And this is due to the, as I said, the corruption. Corruption became an institution under Ben Ali.
Nouredine Jebnoun, he is at Georgetown University. The phones are open. When we come back, we'll hear from many of you. Stay with us. Just before the break, Nadia Bilbasi, you were talking about the wife of the president. We've just had an email from Bill in Cleveland, Ohio, who says, did the wife of Ben Ali, in fact, abscond with gold bars from the state treasury, as has been mentioned in reports, and have the family's accounts now been frozen in France, as has also been speculated?
Well, according to French sources, they're saying that she managed to take 1.5 tons of gold from the central bank. There's no way to verify that, but this is what they're saying. But they arrested 33 members of the Ben Ali Tarabulsi family, and they have exposed today on televisions precious gold and diamond and luxurious lifestyle of yachts and private jets, etc. In fact, she's been dubbed as the Imelda Marcos of the Middle East, or the Marie Antoinette of France. I mean, this woman seems to have like no limit when it comes to greed, and it always amazes me in the Arab world. They're not happy with 1 million or 10 million or 3 million. They have to have 5 billions and 10 billions.
Nouredine Jebnoun, you were born in Tunisia. You have been there since you came here to this country in 2005. How did you see the population there? Some of this has come as a surprise to the world. Did it come as a surprise to you?
It wasn't a surprise to me. This reminded me in 2005, I get like kind of discussion with a friend, and I told him the next time he will be abandoned by the army. I was a professor at the War College at the National Defense University in Tunis at the Commandant General Staff College, where I taught like strategy and geopolitics, and I know well the attitude of the military personnel toward this regime. So the population was impoverished by this regime. So we are talking about this Tunisian miracle, but Tunisian miracle is falling apart because you have almost like 20% of the 20% of the population controlling more than 45% of the riches in this country. So and the imbalance between development and investment between the coast and the countryside is very, very huge in Tunisia.
Ambassador Murphy, during this time of upheaval, what do you believe the position of the United States government can or will be?
We've long had the public position, rhetorical position, that, George W. Bush expressed it very tersely, that stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty. Now, we can all agree with that, we can applaud it, but the question is, how do you implement that? Fine, we can see the results of a lack of liberty, stagnation, resentment, violence, but we have in these various countries a number of interests. I mentioned in regard to Tunisia, it was a very militant anti-terrorism program of the Ben Ali government. We like that, and that certainly influenced the overall public tone of our relationship with Tunisia, as was the public tone in Europe, in France, in other countries who have been closer, actually, to Tunisia than our own government. We have to be tough-minded. We have interests around the area in of a strategic nation, a nature, military, economic, and yet, as Americans, we have to stand by our values. We are great preachers, and we know how other countries should behave in order to develop. But we're not always very adept at presenting our case to the leaders in other countries and to the public. So we'll have to work this one through.
I must say, I think some people were taken aback by Secretary of State Clinton's comments the other day when she spoke at the Forum for the Future. She said that each country, of course, has its own distinct challenges and each its own achievements, but in too many places, in too many ways, the region's foundations are sinking into the sand. The new and dynamic Middle East that I have seen needs firmer ground if it is to take root and grow everywhere. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the U.S. can be instrumental as we see unrest, for example, Lebanon with Hezbollah stepping out, that whole parliament in question now, unrest in Turkey, Saudi Arabia? What more can the U.S. do, Mr. Ambassador?
A lot, as she said, as Secretary Clinton said, will be colored by the situation in the individual countries. The president can lay out the broad parameters of our policies, and she certainly made a very strong statement there at the conference in the Gulf last week. The theme has been picked up by an Arab summit, or foreign minister summit these last days, where the Secretary General of the Arab League spoke of that the Arab soul is broken by poverty, by unemployment, and general recession. He didn't talk about the political repression, which was certainly a very clear characteristic of the situation in Tunisia that stimulated the blow-up starting in December. They have trouble admitting that. Can we talk directly and effectively about ending political repression? We can talk in general terms. We can encourage and should be encouraging civil societies, non-governmental organizations to help those societies develop. We did learn to our chagrin that just calling for early elections is not always an answer, and that those who are better organized on the ground are almost certainly going to win, and they're not always groups which we find consonant with American interests.
Not yet.
I think just to pick up what Ambassador Murphy said, he's absolutely right. Just to look at the malaise that beleaguered all the Arab world, it's the same. It's poverty, unemployment, you know, political repression, lack of freedom, etc. But each country is different and unique. Tunisia might not have a great strategic interest to the United States. Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt does. And the problem with these regimes and maybe the grievances from the Arab people always towards successive American administrations, they always supported dictatorship for the sake of stability at the expense of the people, for the fear that the Islamists will take power. Now, the situation in Egypt is different because we know if there's election, the Muslim Brotherhood will win. It's the same for Jordan, the same in Saudi Arabia, probably even with elements of Salafis and linked to Al-Qaeda. Tunisia is different, as I said, because of the secular nature of the country. But saying that, I think the writing is on the wall for the rest of the regimes. I mean, some of the most interesting reading I've seen that it's not going to be a domino effect. It's not going to be the Berlin Wall of the Arab world, but it's going to be something like the solidarity movement in the Gdansk in Poland, which has basically started the whole revolt against the regimes. It took 9 years for the Soviet Union to crumble at the time, and this is what's going to happen in the Arab world.
Do you agree, Noura?
Yeah, it depends on the regional context. The role that Libya will play, maybe by trying to sabotage and say inside the Tunisian society and to send like maybe mercenaries, is, you know, to destabilize the country, the position of Algeria, if they will accept an emergent, you know, democracy in the country. The other point that I would like to emphasize, people in Tunisia, and I am in constant contact with people there, they were disappointed with the American position since, you know, this revolution came out and started, because the United States didn't condemn directly the regime of Ben Ali when he unleashed his police and his snipers and start killing people, but just Mrs. Clinton, through a statement, she said, like, we are concerned, which concerned has nothing to do with condemning the regime, because the Americans, the France, the Brits, the German, they consider always the dictator Ben Ali for being like their friend. He's a tyrant friend because, you know, he's keeping a firm hand on all those Islamists. This is the issue. This is the issue.
Now, here's an email from Saidu in Cincinnati, Ohio. He says, being originally from Mauritania, which has a similar history of dictatorship, I am hoping that these events spread throughout the Maghreb. However, I am also concerned about the Islamist threat. What are the chances that Al-Qaeda will take over these countries if the populations revolt? Nuruddin.
So I think Islamism is a highly diversified and complex ideology. Islamism in Tunisia does not always equal radicalism, and that radicalism is not necessarily synonymous with terrorism. The Islamist movement is a general concept in the Arab world and in the Maghreb, including like broad range of Islamic thought from Erdogan to Taliban, including Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, Sheikh Rashid al-Ghannouchi, Abbasi Madani, Sheikh Yassin, you know, and others. So we should understand like during the colonial period, this region overdosed, you know, a traumatic westernization. And Islamism manifests itself as a direct reaction of this phenomenon. Okay, what I would like to say, and here I would like to paraphrase my friend Jean-François Burga, who is a great political science. He's a French. And he said, you know, the Quran cannot explain Osama bin Laden any more than the Bible can explain the Irish Republican Army.
Let me add something also that you asked, Diane, in the beginning, what generate the sympathy? The act that Bouazizi, the young 26-year-old unemployed university graduate, took, it wasn't a suicide bombing. He did not kill himself and he did not kill civilians. He went and he burned himself alive. Something new in the Arab world. You see this with the Buddhist monks in Asia, in Vietnam, but not in the Arab world. All of a sudden, there's so many Bouazizis all over in Algeria, in Egypt, in Mauritania, as the caller just mentioned. So this is generate sympathy because it wasn't just an opposition holding a placard to say down with the regime. This
but
guy was willing to burn himself.
We are left with the question of whether Al-Qaeda could step in.
Well, that's my point. I think because of the sympathy to this person, I don't think they can. Of course, they're always trying to exploit any political chaos. There is no doubt about this. But in Tunisia in particular, I think, as Nouruddin just said, the Islamists are different. Even Al-Nahda party, which was now it's a new name for the Muslim Brotherhood, was banned during Bin Ali. And now his leader, Al-Ghannouchi, was no relation to the Prime Minister's returning. He's talking about an open Islam that embraced democracy and embraced all kind of pluralism in the Tunisian society. So it's different from Salafis and Al-Qaeda.
Nadia Bill Basie, senior U.S. correspondent for NBC TV, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Sofiane here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
All right. Just wanted to let you know I'm a U.S. Navy veteran, and my father is a Tunisian military veteran. We served in the same time in two different countries. One thing you need to know about Tunisian is even if Al-Qaeda try to come tomorrow, I would guarantee you 90 to 95% of the people that live there will actually topple them just like the top of the dictator. I know what Tunisians are compromised. They're an open society. They rely heavily on tourism. People speak 3, 4, 5 different languages. They are business-minded, or you know, they are very educated. As a matter of fact, I believe they are the most educated in all the Arab and African countries per capita. So the notion that terrorism or Al-Qaeda, and I worked in anti-terrorism, will come to Tunisia is really null. It will never happen.
Nouruddin, you agree?
Yeah, I agree. You know, Al-Qaeda is there before this revolution. And if you want to talk about Al-Qaeda, you should go back to what happened in Algeria in the 90s, 1990, 1991, the annulment of those elections by the military junta and the coup d'etat, the military coup against the democratic process. And then the infiltration by the intelligence Algerian intelligence services of all those Islamist movement, and it seems like the Al-Qaeda justify the authoritarianism in North Africa and especially in Algeria and justify a kind of close military and security cooperation between those regimes and the United States. So the equation is either us or the vacuum.
All right, to Bristol, Tennessee. Good morning, Norman.
Good morning. As a U.S. citizen, I'm actually embarrassed by the hypocrisy of some of our leadership that they are dictating to these other countries and pointing fingers with what we've seen happen in this country, with the way the previous administration took us into these illegal wars and the way Congress is fighting and grappling. It's, to me, it's disgusting.
Ambassador Murphy.
Dan, I'd like to say that I certainly hope, and I defer to Professor Jabnoun, given his background, his experience in Tunisia, I certainly hope that what we're seeing is a new political class, the youths who do not favor either a secular tyranny or Islamic radicalism. I think that's a great that would be a great development. And I do think we have been, as a nation, too ready to blur the distinctions between Islamism, terrorism, Islamic radicalism. I think we have to be more careful in our analysis and our public political pronouncements about the movements that we really do oppose, such as Al-Qaeda.
You know, I talked to the youth those recent days, and what they told me openly, we want to escape from those, from this face-to-face with France, with this Francophonie, and we would like the United States to help us to open like the country to us, to come here to study, to make the English like the language of business, the main language in the country instead of France. Because what the French government did, it's a misassessment of the situation, and to the last minute they want even to send to us their police, their CRS, to oppress, to back Ben Ali and to oppress like to oppress the people in Tunisia. And Tunisian people, they said, we would like to be more close to the United States and to have a good relation with the United States and to come to the universities here. This is what the youth want.
Nuruddin Jibnoun, he is at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
The future of public broadcasting. Consumers have thousands of options for information and entertainment, and Congress is threatening to cut government funding. Challenges and opportunities facing public radio and television. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We have callers on the line from Columbia, Missouri, Alexandria, Virginia, Fort Worth, Texas. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Let's go to Columbia, Missouri, and to Elena. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane, I listen to you every day.
Thank you
very much for the outstanding programs you have.
Thank you.
I would like to congratulate the lady journalist, which she's telling you the fact about the Tunisian people. And I like to congratulate the Tunisians for the outstanding effort to get rid of this thief dictator. Congratulations, the Tunisian brothers. Don't kill each other. Bring this man to the justice. Call the ICC to bring him back and try him right there.
Thank you so much for your call, Elena. Nuruddin Jibnoun, this was truly, in a larger sense, a revolutionary revolution because it came from the people, by the people.
By the people, yeah. So it came from the people, by the people, and hopefully will be for the people. In this case, the army played a very important role. The neutrality of the army in Tunisia. The Tunisian army has its idiosyncrasies in comparison to the other armies in the Arab region. It's very republican army. It's a small army, 45,000 soldier, very professional, efficient, operational, efficacious, in comparison with what Ben Ali, like, left to us. It's almost 180,000 policemen. It's a sclerotic and a large security apparatuses infiltrated by militias. And the army is took the side of the people and said to the foreign president, will not fire on the people. And imagine the chief of staff, the president gave him the choice to resign or to fire, and he chose to resign. This is very important. Never happened in the third world, including Latin America or Africa or the Arab world. This is the first time. And
there is another factor, which is modern technology, the fact that WikiLeaks social media played an important role here, Nadia.
Absolutely, Diane. And this would just say that this revolution has been dubbed as the Jasmine Revolution. We didn't mention that. This is, will add to the velvet, to the rose, to the orange revolutions that toppled communism in Eastern Europe. So I was saying to you that there's so many factors actually of why this is successful. First, it didn't even come on the bank of American tank like we have seen in the toppling of Saddam Hussein, another dictator in the Middle East, at the expense of hundreds of thousands of people dead and a war that cost so much money and life, etc. It started with the people, as I said. It's a massive movement. Social media has played a vital role. My Facebook was flooded with messages demanding the release of political prisoners, saying down with the dictator. Now, the traditional Arab media cannot maybe be relied upon to tell the Arab people what's happening. So people resorted to other means, which is Twitter, Facebook, text messages, to organize masses of people in the streets. And I think this is very important. And because of WikiLeaks has confirmed everything that we knew about the corruption within the Ben Ali family, it gave people another dimension to say maybe this is the new first WikiLeaks revolution.
And to Ambassador Murphy, here's a question from Antoine, who says, are there lessons from the Iranian revolution in 1979 where the middle class switched sides for the situation in Tunisia, or is it more like the peaceful evolution in Spain or Korea? Ambassador Murphy.
I would say it's closer to the Spanish situation. Mm. You know, there's great excitement now, uneasiness, obviously, in the part of some of the other regimes in the area, and a number of commentators talking about Gdansk and the Berlin Wall. Authoritarianism has been broken through. But a lot's going to depend on how clever some of these other regimes are in preserving themselves. Are they going to listen to opinions such as Secretary Clinton expressed, or is that going to be too painful? Now, some of them may get hold of the idea that it's time to open up politically, to listen to their people and take note of what the youth are asking for, which is certainly jobs. They don't have anything to survive on, so many of them, but it's also a need to be able to express themselves and to take a share in running the country.
And now a call from Robin Wright, who has certainly been in that area, has written extensively. Good morning to you, Robin.
Good morning, Diane. I actually was in Tunisia in the 1970s when Ben Ali's predecessor was elected president for life. But I have a question about the Islamic issue, because you've addressed al-Qaeda, but what about those in exile, people like Rashid Ghannouchi, who, unlike Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, who was in Iraq most of his exile, the Tunisians have been largely in Western Europe. Rashid Ghannouchi has been in London for more than a decade. what role are they likely to play? Many of them have talked about going back. What are these people who are not al-Qaeda sympathizers, who've talked about freedom of the press and who've been talking about some of the issues that the protesters are now addressing, what role will they play?
Nuruddin.
I think Al-Ghannouchi, even when he will go back to Tunisia, he has like a very specific discourse about the, which is very moderate, to be part of the government, because we couldn't have a government without by ignoring the Islamists. The Islamists must be like a part of the political equation. The problem here, he spent like more than 20 years outside the country, and I think he was cut from the reality on the ground. You have youth, you have some of them were radicalized by the previous regime, and how to be able to bring them and to build a kind of confidence with those young. This is young people. This is very important. This is a huge challenge for the Nahda and for the Islamist movement in Tunisia.
Thanks for your call, Robin. Let's go now to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Alpha. Alpha, are you there? As I understand it, the question from Alpha was, given the fact that France is a former power in Tunisia, what is the attitude there? Why now, given what's happening in Tunisia?
I remember the speech of President Sarkozy 2 years ago in Tunisia. He said, we prefer Ben Ali than Taliban. He reduced the whole society, very civilized, very smart society, to Taliban, black or white. You know, Ben Ali, he presented himself like a rampart against terrorism, against Islamism, which is not true. He created this situation on the ground to justify like repression, to justify, authoritarianism. This is what those dictatorships, this is what those Arab Pinochet try to do in the Arab world, just to say to the United States, either us or you will have like Islamists, and with Islamists you will not be able to get anything, you will not be able to negotiate with those people.
Are there any leaders who can rise to become cultural leaders, as we saw in Poland? Are there within that mass of young people or statespersons people who will rise?
Yeah, we have for example, Judge Mukhtar Yahyaoui, who was like fired in 2001 because he protested against the absence of the independence of the judiciary body. This guy will be able to lead a kind of civil society or an opposition within Tunisian society. Now, I think we are in the, it's the momentum of learning. We try to learn. We try to learn what's democracy, what's pluralism, what's freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of thought. This is, we are in just like a step of learning.
And do you want to go back?
I want to go back, but to contribute, to help like my compatriots, but I haven't any intention to run for any
now.
Political position now. Yeah,
you want to wait and see
what happens, and the transitional, you know, period, this transitional period for 6 months, what we will do. Because I think the priority is to start like thinking about rewriting the constitution, because what we have now, we haven't even a presidential system, we have a presidentialist system. You know what we need a parliamentary system where the prime minister could be held like responsible before the parliamentaries of the people. This is what we need a kind of check and balance between the three main power, judiciary, executive, and legislative.
All right, to Alexandria, Virginia. Hassan, good morning.
Good morning to you, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir. Go right ahead.
I am so happy, as every Arab happy today, to see this dictator gone. I am very frustrated with American media did not cover the protest for 30 days. They covered them the last day when he fled. And all what United States said, they worry about an ally is leaving. And also the media talked about the protesters as rioters. I pay attention to this. Why United States media called them rioters instead of demonstrators, for one. Second, why Mr. Ali, the president, fled to Saudi Arabia? Did the United States ask Saudi Arabia to accept him? I need really to know. Because this, we think this is a good sign for the Arab world to follow suit. I think, unfortunately, the opposite. The United States is going to enforce their grip in Mubarak, Saudi Arabia, all the Arab dictators. Remember, these dictators are there just thanks to the United States support and keep them in power. And Mr. Murphy, the ambassador, knows that very well, but I like him to be very honest and courageous to say the truth about it. And please, drop the Islamists.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nadia, do you want to begin?
Yes. I mean, talking about why he ended up in Saudi Arabia, because no other country will take him. I mean, there's reports saying that he tried to land in France. They said no. He tried to land in Malta. They said no. He tried
Did
in Egypt.
Did the U.S. exert any influence in getting the Saudis to take him?
I don't know, but I doubt it, because the Saudis have a history of hosting these people. I mean, they have Idi Amin of Uganda, who committed atrocities. They had Nawaz al-Sharif, who was deposed. Mm-hmm. And the Saudi official line was basically that it is the hospitality of the Bedouin Arabs, that whoever comes to them, regardless if he was a dictator or not, they have to be accepted. Saying that, he's not allowed, according to the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, he's not allowed to practice any political activities or to say anything, and it seems like he's going to stay there temporarily and he's going to move on.
You know, under Ben Ali, you have at least 30,000 Tunisians were imprisoned and jailed. 3,000 were seriously tortured, and more than 80 were killed and disappeared.
Why did you leave?
I resigned from my position. I was like professor at the War College in Tunisia, and I left because I don't agree with the policy of this government. That's it. And I think if I stay there, the risk like to stay alive, it's not very, very high for me, you know.
Then so there's the question of why the Tunisian people put up with this for so long. Is it a confluence of, as we said, social media plus this young man self-immolating plus a growing unrest? I mean, everything sort of came together.
Right. I mean, in the history of revolutions in general, we don't know what that moment that sparks that particular event at that time. I remember I was in Gaza in 87 during the first Intifada. Why the Palestinians didn't revolt for 30 years? And it took one accident. It was a car accident at the time that sparked the Intifada. But there is, of course, there's accumulation of all the factors that we talked during the show, with political repression, you know, with lack of freedom. But the bottom line here, it is they're reducing the Arab people to a nation of beggars, all the dictatorship in the Arab world. Just to give you some statistics, Diane, I mean, the Arab world has the highest number of unemployment in the world. They have 115 million out of the working force of 300 million people. Most of them cannot find jobs. The 20% of the Arab people live on less than $2 a day. And 40% less on $2.70 a day. We're talking about, this is one of the wealthiest nations on earth. And yet, this is the statistics that we have to deal with.
Ambassador Murphy, do you believe that what has happened in Tunisia may indeed spread to other Arab countries and affect the way the United States deals with the Arab world?
I don't think it'll spread immediately to other Arab countries, but the new media certainly kept the entire region aware of what's been going on in Tunisia, which wasn't the situation a decade ago. They had to listen to the voice of authority through the newspapers, the radios, their television. Today they don't. They have their own channels. The challenge to us is going to be critical over these, let's say, next 6 months in Tunisia, to identify the liberals, to support the moderates, and we better be humble in doing so. We've not always been correct in picking the eventual winners. But we have to listen carefully.
I'll have to stop you right there. Richard Murphy, he served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia. Nuruddin Jebnoun, he's adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. Nadia Bilbasi, she serves on our Friday News Roundup panels. She is with NBC TV. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Dan.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.